This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As the weather turns cold, individuals and families who don't have permanent housing face even more worry. The state of Vermont and various nonprofit agencies have long tried to address homelessness in the state, and recent reports suggest they might be making progress. But every year when they do a point-in-time count in the beginning of the year to try to gauge how many Vermonters are without permanent homes, they find more than 1,000 people still fit that category. So today on the show, we're going to talk about what's being done to find more stable housing and to help those who are facing insecurity. We're also going to talk about why overall homelessness may be going down, but the number of families made homeless because of domestic abuse is on the rise. I'm joined now by Sean Brown. He's Deputy Commissioner of the Department for Children and Families. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And by Peter Kellerman, Assistant Director of John Graham Housing and Services in Vergennes and co-chair of the Vermont Coalition to End Homelessness. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Hello to both of you.
Sean, can you start us off just by, I mentioned over 1,000 Vermonters are known or assumed to be homeless. What are the most current numbers on how many Vermonters are homeless?
Sure. Every year, it's called a point-in-time count, is done early in the year, where they do a very thorough survey on one night during the winter to gauge how many homeless individuals and families there are in the state. And last year, as you indicated, that number showed there was just over 1,100 individuals or families in the state compared to just over 1,500 the year before.
And in doing that point-in-time survey, you're counting people who are in shelters, you're counting people who are living rough?
It might be living on the streets. They might be staying in a motel that they were placed in by our general assistance program. So they count very different categories of people that are homeless.
Although you're probably not counting or capturing people who face home insecurity but are couch surfing or, sort of cobbling together temporary measures that don't involve vouchers or shelters or aren't found on the street.
Right. We may miss individuals who are couch surfing or staying with families who are we consider homeless.
Peter Kellerman, what do you attribute that decrease in the number to? Sean Brown mentioned just over 1,100 at the beginning of this year when that point-in-time survey was done, and that was down 28% from the previous year's census. Are there reasons that you can see that count would be going down?
Jane, there's a couple of answers that I can provide there. Right off the bat, I want to mention that at this moment, John Graham Housing and Services, we own 5 buildings. They're all full. We have 65 folks in shelter, and on that particular night, there was only 77 families found without a home. So it's kind of relative. We've got 11 families with children, large families with us at the moment. So I'm going to say that one night offered some glimmer of hope, but it is not enough to create a reliable baseline. And furthermore, given the numbers that I just mentioned of folks that we've got in our shelter, I would just suggest that although there's some positive signs, we've got a long way to go, and we're not raising any victory flag at this point.
Is there a better way, do you think, to gauge numbers? I mean, point in time, it's difficult to track people who are moving around and to track people who aren't receiving regular services. So do you see a way to do it that might allow for more accuracy or at least acknowledge that these numbers fluctuate?
I do think that there's an effort to be more accountable, to accumulate more reliable statistics, but it's virtually impossible to get a definitive accurate figure at any given night. If we remember, last winter was also very mild. It was a mild winter in general. I'm sure that contributed to some of the outcome. But we're in the process of trying to, I think, upgrade our data information to see if we can improve on that. But I think the proof is in the pudding, and it's just, as I say, as of today, we have 65 people in the shelter.
Deputy Commissioner Brown, what do you think about finding ways to make that assessment either more accurate or more changeable as those numbers change?
Sure. As John indicated, that really is just one measure that we use. We look at it throughout the perspective of our program that we operate, the Emergency Assistance Program. And so we look at who's coming in our doors. What are what are the reasons they're homeless? What time of year are they coming in? And so we're always monitoring that. And so for us, that's a good gauge of what we're seeing. Our program's really the last resort. Once all the other shelters and infrastructure is full, then we have to fall back on the emergency housing program. And that's one indicator we use as well.
We're talking today about homelessness in Vermont. Listeners, if you have some experience with this, what do you think would be the most helpful way to get people into stable housing situations? How have you managed? You can call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. One of the disturbing things that you've been discovering about people who are homeless in Vermont is that a rising number of them are becoming homeless because of domestic abuse. Peter Kellerman, how so? How does that work?
Well, there's no two ways about it. One of those families that I just mentioned recently came to us with just in the past few days, and a rather large family, victims of domestic violence. We see this regularly. We work very closely with the Women's Advocate Group here in Addison County, who do a great job. And we particularly try and be as sensitive as possible to address those needs, because they happen quite often. And throughout the year, at any given time, we always have a few folks who are suffering from domestic violence in our shelter.
And it's because, you try to get out of a bad situation, but you may not have enough money to get your own apartment or to get yourself out and find housing. I mean, just paint us a picture here for people who are...
Absolutely. If someone is in a crisis due to domestic violence, there's no telling whether that particular parent is a working parent, if they have resources available. Quite often they're a victim in so many ways, including financially, and they're left high and dry with absolutely nothing. Their safety for themselves and their children becomes a critical issue, and the need to act quickly and rush to safety is a very difficult challenge, let alone trying to find housing and safe refuge. So it's often an untenable situation, and without some of the folks that we have from community partners, I'm not really sure just what would happen with these folks.
Sean Brown, why do you think that number is rising?
We've been talking with our domestic violence partners across the state to understand that, because we are seeing a large rise in the number of coming in seeking our services. And we haven't been able to put our finger on what's causing the rise, but it's certainly concerning and growing. And it's something we're trying to address as quickly as we can.
Do you have any understanding of whether domestic abuse in general is rising in Vermont? I mean, does the fact that more people who are becoming homeless can attribute domestic abuse as the cause for that, does that suggest that actually the problem of domestic abuse just on the whole is on the rise?
Our sense is that domestic violence has been a pretty large problem in Vermont for a while, and it's just manifesting itself now for us through seeing it through the emergency housing and homelessness issue, particularly as the housing market is so tight and people are struggling even just in general to afford housing, that this is a symptom we're seeing for that population.
Our number again, if you have a question or an experience to share to help help people understand what this is like, what homelessness is like, what it feels like, what it is caused by, and how you get out of it, is 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Craig, who's calling in from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hi, Craig. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, Craig. You there? All right, Craig, we'll try to come back to you. We got a note from Devin who says, coming in from Los Angeles, I'm extremely used to homeless people. What I'm not used to is a lack of clarity of resources. Vermont needs a clearer route in its more metropolitan regions to give homeless people a path back to living on their own, be that through halfway housing or live-in programs that range from assisted to free to move. Okay, so for somebody who is struggling, either lost their job and can't afford their apartment, or is trying to get away from domestic abuse like we just talked about, or is dealing with other issues like mental health problems or drug abuse that make maintaining stable housing problematic or difficult, Sean Brown, what resources are available to those people?
Sure. There are actually quite a few resources available to individuals who are homeless and might be suffering from some of the things you mentioned. We have really been focusing on trying to coordinate our services and entry into the system to receive services with all of our community partners and our district offices across the state, so that no matter what door you come in, that you have access to all of those services. And so we've actually been investing some of our resources into improving those resources as well. So if someone coming in is suffering substance abuse, mental illness, has a medical condition, or needs employment services, that those are quickly focused to help that person become stabilized and get them rehoused as quickly as possible.
But where do they go? Where would I go first?
You come to one of our district offices. We're located in 12 regions across the state. Walk in, say you need assistance, and then that quickly gets the ball rolling. Also, another great resource is 211. Calling that, and they can hook you up with providers and services in that area of the state very quickly as well.
Peter, Devin said, that there ought to be more transparent or obvious or easy ways to access services. Do you think that there are enough services and that they're visible enough in the communities for Vermonters who need help?
Well, I think that there are plenty of resources. But in working as a service provider, folks who are in crisis and experiencing trauma, it's very difficult to navigate those services in general, and we're all aware of that, I think, as service providers and doing our best to try and alleviate some of that struggle. 211 is an excellent community partner in providing a number of resources on behalf of the entire state. And as Sean mentioned, there's plenty of folks locally, whether it's economic services, community action. Many of us have websites that have our numbers available. And although there's always room for improvement, I think that we're on the right track. But feedback like that is pretty indicative of folks who are really faced with some critical challenges. And, having a starting point is very difficult. So, to some extent, that's going to be the case for most folks. But I think Vermont is doing a pretty good job in trying to network with folks and get their services out there.
When you say for somebody in crisis, accessing services, even if they're readily available, can be difficult, give us an example of that and how then you do try to work with people who are in a crisis and really need help immediately but may not be in a great position to be doing a lot of searching around or filing paperwork or sitting down and talking to people.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, a great example, we just took in a fairly large family where their situation deteriorated very quickly while they were busy trying to figure out what they were going to do if they should become homeless. There were other things that became critical issues, too, as where children will end up going to school if they had to leave the area, how they were going to maybe satisfy some health needs with if income had changed, which in fact it did due to hardship and injury. And this level of confusion, this level of crisis makes it very difficult to think clearly and act efficiently. It's just part of the human condition. So you've got a gentleman here who not long ago was holding a high position, had a lot of authority, made a good income from his family. And at the moment, he doesn't have health care. He just found out about it last night. But, how does that happen? Accessing health care is not all that difficult. And we're sitting down with him this morning and making that call to Vermont Health Connect to remedy that. But this is a gentleman who had plenty of personal agency and was able to think clearly and help others in emergency situations. And in the midst of his own crisis and trying to take care of his family, something as crucial as health care kind of slipped through the cracks.
Yeah, you can see how overwhelming it would be to try to be dealing with all of those things at once.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Auburn, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Auburn. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Auburn Watersong. I'm actually the policy director at the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And I just want to start by saying thank you to Sean Brown for his partnership and work in the work that we try to do around our coalition member programs throughout the state. We have 15 domestic and sexual violence programs, and 9 of which are shelters. I appreciate you opening up this conversation about the population of domestic violence victims that make up the population of homeless Vermonters. And I just wanted to shed a little light on that from the domestic violence services perspective, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
We have actually a shelter network out there that is experiencing a bottleneck. And what we're seeing as the cause of this increase in the homeless population in the state system, in the emergency hotel and motel system, is due to a lack of affordable housing on the other end of our emergency shelter care. You know, 20 years ago when I started this work, the emergency shelters were housing women for a maximum of about 6 weeks, housing victims of domestic and sexual violence for 6 weeks was usually the max. Now we're up to 6 months because there is a lack of affordable housing for them to go to. And so Vermont really has a crisis in affordable housing that's creating this bottleneck such that our shelters are turning away victims, and those victims are then forced into the emergency shelter system.
Auburn, thanks. I appreciate your call again. Auburn, representing the Vermont Network Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And that's exactly where we're going to go next. We're going to talk about what are the housing options that are available and, you know, where beyond shelters does the state go? What resources are available and where is this bottleneck and what can be done about it? Again, if you have a question or an experience to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're taking a look at homelessness in Vermont and steps the state and organizations are taking to combat this problem. Especially as the winter weather sets in, this is something that people are thinking about. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 with your questions or your experiences. Or you can share a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with DCF Deputy Commissioner Sean Brown and with Peter Kellerman from John Graham Housing and Services in Vergennes. He's also co-chair of the Vermont Coalition to End Homelessness. And let's go to Kenny, who's calling in from Hyde Park. Hi, Kenny. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I have a few houses in Lamoille County with my father that need some repair, and they're behind in taxes. And I'm just wondering if there's someone out there that could partner with us to get these places up and provide housing for people in need.
Kenny, thanks for your call. You're not the only one wondering about affordable housing. Mary says, I've been reading about the shortage of affordable housing all my life. She says, I'm 82 now. One main reason for the shortage has been that builders find little profit in it. What are the main obstacles to creating affordable housing in Vermont now? I've been reading about initiatives for the past 10 years. Are there any new approaches? Peter Kellerman, can you weigh in on Kenny's question about his own housing that he has that maybe could be fixed up and any partnerships that are available out there?
One of the great attributes, I think, of Vermont is that there's a lot of opportunity for grassroots movements. I think that, you know, locally we have Front Porch Forum where communities can communicate with each other and put that need out. And quite often I think it's easier and somewhat less painful to use those venues as opposed to trying to access funds maybe from a state or federal level. Everybody is aware of those things, those challenges that are out there, and just because it's not a perfect system, it's very difficult to sometimes capitalize on good ideas. You know, one of the things that has worked very well, aside from the fact that we definitely have a shortage of affordable housing and that there's plenty of work that needs to be done on that, is that we still have some outlets that have been working quite well. At the John Graham Shelter, we use a three-pronged approach when it comes to housing folks. Once they come into our care and we assess their needs and set some goals with them, quite often we're able to sign them up for a rental subsidy through economic services, which will help subsidize their rent so that it'll minimize the portion that they have to pay and make things a little more reasonable. And along with the a commitment to ongoing service from us to ensure that folks are safely housed and then they get the support they need once they're housed to be successful, we have found that that formula is working quite well for us and leaves us very hopeful. So we're particularly grateful for Economic Services for that particular option.
You know, this spring, Governor Shumlin signed into law an order that says owners of housing that receive state funds will need to make at least 15% of their housing units available to homeless Vermonters. It's only been a few months since that order was signed, but are you seeing or anticipating any benefit to come of that?
Absolutely. I think that I can say, at least in my experience, that locally Addison County Community Trust has been an excellent partner in fulfilling those types of agreements, and that has enabled us to enjoy a very good, healthy success rate. Statewide, I couldn't comment. I think it's still a program that's in its infancy, and in some places it's probably further along than others, but it's certainly a good question.
Let's go to Eric in Johnson. Eric, hi, you're on Vermont Edition.
Hi, good morning, Jane. Great conversation. I'd like to bring up the situation of a family I'm aware of that is couch surfing, moving from one bad situation to another. They've been evicted. The parents are separated, so there's a custody order. So that makes it complicated for where they can move. And I don't know that this type of person has been counted in the homeless situation, but they certainly are. And it's what it's affecting is all the kids in this home, and no one even knows that they're homeless. It's just it's really difficult to watch. And I wonder if there's any insight on that. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, Eric, thank you for your call. What a tough situation. I want to get one more call in, and then we're going to turn to Sean Brown for some advice on resources. Abdiner is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Abdiner, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Yes, and first I want to say something about 211. I remember it was 6 months ago, I called 211, a friend of mine, who was not at a place to sleep, and then the gentleman who answered at that evening told us to call some housing, shelter. And then all the shelters, they told us is full. We called back the 211 guy back again. And then he said, if the shelters are full, I have no place. I have nothing to help you. The other question made me to call today was, I know a friend of mine, I just know her here. She's a mother, single mother, I think four or five kids. She worked full-time job that I think it's like 12 or 10-hour shift. And she gets paid weekly, probably 300. And she's behind her, the place she lives is to 1200 a month. So she pays October money, like the half of November. And she comes to me yesterday, I met her, and I didn't know where to point to her. And Economic Service is not helping. The housings, Burlington housings or Winnisca housings, at least even she showed me a letter that from the landlord told her, if you're not able to pay the money, you should exit. And it was very scary. Mother with five kids and school going. And she's new, even 6 months or less from Africa.
Abdinur, let me turn to Sean Brown for some advice here. And your line was a little bit iffy a couple of times there. So he was making a couple of comments. Number one was when he was trying to help a friend with a housing situation and called 211, the person who he spoke to said, here are the numbers to call. Go call these shelters. They were all full. They called back 211, and 211 said, I'm sorry, if there's nothing available, we can't help you. And then now he's trying to help out a friend who's a mother with several children who's behind on her rent and very worried that she might lose her housing situation. So Sean Brown, between Eric, who knows a family that's couch surfing and basically doesn't have stable housing. And Abdinur, who is worried about a friend who may lose her housing, also has kids. What do these families do? Where should they go, and how do they find help?
Sure. Well, there are certainly resources available to help both those families in need. One, they should reach out to us, visit our district office, or they can call my office, and we can help them through to connect them with the proper service provider. But we do provide funding to our partners to help families who are on the verge of becoming homeless because they've fallen behind in rent. We certainly want to prevent people from losing their housing just because it's very difficult to obtain new housing given the housing market, so that we can – there's financial resources available to help people stay in their homes. And then for families that are couch surfing, we certainly want to get them in stable, permanent housing, and we have resources available throughout the state that we can hook them up with. If we know about them, we can help them.
So, you know, the bottom line is they need to reach out to
yes.
get access to services. But, you know, we were talking earlier with Peter Kellerman about how difficult it can be if you're in crisis and you're trying to do so many different things, particularly if you're also working and maybe you work in a job that doesn't have a lot of flexibility mm-hmm. to allow you to go to various appointments or to make calls at the office. Or, you know, you're trying to also take care of kids and you're worried about their situation and where they're going to go to school and where is this housing situation going to be? Is it going to be in a different school district? How do you deal with all of that? It can be overwhelming just to try to reach out for those services. And then if you get a call, you know, call 211 and they say, here's a list of numbers to call. I mean, I can imagine that might seem like an overwhelming burden.
Yes. And, you know, I would love to talk to that caller more offline about that experience to understand a little bit more of that. That's not our agreement and how that's supposed to work with 211. So I certainly would want to understand that a little bit deeper on that circumstance. You know, we certainly want to accommodate families and meet them where they're at. So if that means meeting them offsite, not at a district office, we are happy to do that. But we just need to be able to have that initial contact with that family so we know they're in need. And then we can triage their individual circumstances. We certainly want to keep children in their home school district so they can maintain those relationships with their peers, which are very important as well, and those family connections. So we certainly have the ability to work with those families. We just need to have that initial contact.
And the easiest way to make that initial contact is that to call 211 and get access to resources if you don't know where a district office is or you don't have stable internet?
Absolutely. If you're completely do not know, call 211. They can direct you to their nearest local district office or a provider to provide, you know, one of our community partners, or walk into our district office. And that opens the door to many avenues and opportunities for us to serve those families.
Our number, if you'd like to share a question or an experience, we're talking about homelessness today. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Anne is calling in from Shrewsbury. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I have just retired from teaching in the public school system for 32 years. I have a lot of concerns about people who are not able to take care of themselves, basically. And I'd like to hear some numbers on is how many people, what percent of the population is homeless, what percent are women with no man helping to support with children, how many are men, how many people have jobs. And to me, that's the most important factor, is if you can't afford housing, is it because you don't have a job, because your job doesn't pay enough? I mean, I'd like to know that. And I just don't think we have enough information. The same goes for people who are opiate addicted. How many people are actually employed? And I'd like to know that. So I think there's a huge, huge need for somehow the state to create a job bank for people so they actually earn money to provide for themselves. And so this ties into something that also is really important to me. And this is research done by Abraham Maslow, a psychologist from, I don't know when exactly when he lived, probably the 1950s. He developed a hierarchy of needs, which is a pyramid of needs. The bottom one is food and shelter. This is where we all have to have all of these to evolve personally. So the bottom is food and shelter. Then we have safety. Then the next one up is a sense of belonging, to like your community or your family. The next one would be developing a sense of self-esteem through education and good and work that supports your strengths. And the very top one is self-actualization, which is your personal growth, fulfillment of your potential. So I'm really concerned about the model of giving people housing when it's not that that in itself is wrong, but mm-hmm. the underlying problem is that people need to be able to provide for themselves.
Well, Anne, let's pick that up. So, Sean Brown, first of all, do you have a breakdown of the statistics of the actual demographics of people who are homeless in Vermont, men, women, people with partners versus people without, or families might be a way to look at that as well. And then we can talk about jobs. You know, how do we find people stable jobs, and then that how that goes along with housing.
Sure. We do have the demographic information and the household information. We're aware of that, and we analyze it and help us develop any services we want to provide. In terms of...
Can you tell us what they are?
I don't have those specific in front of me. I can tell you that we served just last year in state fiscal year 15, I should say 2 years ago, just over 3,100 households. And then last year, we in the emergency housing program, we served just over 2,100 households. And we of those last year, 1,354 were children, homeless children in the state. And that's a pretty shockingly large number and concerning. Our experience is many of the families coming seeking services have income, have employment. They've just suffered some sort of crisis, either domestic violence, loss of a job, experienced a health condition where they weren't able to work. They fell behind in rent, and next thing you know, they've lost their housing. And so many do contribute what they can towards their housing, and then we make up the difference to help them get stabilized. So many of the people coming in for services are employed. They're not in high-wage jobs for sure, but they're trying to get by the best they can.
Peter Kellerman, maybe you can speak to this as well, because we've talked with folks at the John Graham Shelter before on shows that look at homelessness, and many of the people who are seeking help from your services do have jobs or find jobs but still aren't necessarily able to support themselves and their families and find housing that they can pay for on their own.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Jane. There's I'm just thinking of an incident not long ago of a parent of three, a single parent of three children, older children, great job with in a hospital, making a fairly good salary, and 6 months after becoming homelessness, there was an exasperated parent trying to figure out what they're doing wrong. And, of course, they weren't doing anything wrong. This person did a fabulous job maintaining employment in the midst of some pretty steep odds and taking care of three children, and just had to stick with it. We did our best to keep spirits high and to stay positive. It was, in this particular instance, just a shortage of affordable housing. And also, in order to keep folks in school where they're at and not disrupt that continuity for those kids, to try and find something that was going to be close to both work and school. So it was kind of like a perfect storm for a while, but this is pretty typical. A lot of our folks do work, they have a decent wage, and still have difficulty finding it. Now, if you consider that, also consider that there's a lot of our folks who are working minimum wage, and without a rental subsidy, there is just no way they're going to be able to afford housing.
That's Peter Kellerman. He's Assistant Director of John Graham Housing and Services based in Vergennes and co-chair of the Vermont Coalition to End Homelessness. Peter, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We've also been talking with Sean Brown, Deputy Commissioner of the Vermont Department for Children and Families. Deputy Commissioner Brown, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with Vermont's next Attorney General, T.J. Donovan. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For nearly 20 years, Vermonters have known one attorney general, Bill Sorrell. But the longtime Democratic AG decided not to run this year, and his challenger from the 2012 primary, T.J. Donovan, captured the Democratic nomination and then won the election. Donovan has been Chittenden County State's attorney since 2006. As he prepares to move into the position of top law enforcement officer for the state of Vermont, he joins us now. T.J. Donovan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
You ran for this position, as I mentioned, 4 years ago against Bill Sorrell and lost very narrowly in the primary. Can you tell us what lessons you learned from that campaign that helped you this year other than just don't go up against an incumbent in a primary?
Well, actually, that was, I would say that was the opposite of what I learned. It was, I would say, we should have primaries and we should have substantive debates in our campaigns. And a lot of the issues that we debated about during that 2012 election later were enacted into law because of that campaign. It was a very substantive issue-based campaign. We did it the Vermont way, and I think it was a good thing, certainly for me, and I think it was a good thing for Attorney General Sorrell as well. He said as much. So I came out learning that, number one, talking about the issues is a good thing. Getting around this state, talking to regular Vermonters about what they expect government to do for them is a healthy thing. And just from a personal standpoint, it was an absolute privilege to campaign in this state. And so I learned a lot. I learned that Vermont, although we say it's a small state, is a large state. And campaigning takes a lot of time and takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of money, unfortunately. And so you have to be all in. And I think I brought those lessons with me this time, and luckily we prevailed.
You've said that the opiate crisis is the number one issue for your office to tackle. So how do you see your office working to solve that problem?
Yeah, I think, number one, we have to have a coordinated response throughout the state. And addressing the heroin epidemic goes hand in hand with reforming our criminal justice system. And we have to have not 14 different systems of justice based on our counties, but one. And why the Attorney General's office is so important, of course, is because it has concurrent statewide jurisdiction with our state's attorneys. And earlier this year, Governor Shulman's pretrial monitoring system, which was based somewhat on a program we started in Chittenden County, was moved from the Department of Corrections to the Attorney General's office. And that was a very significant move for a couple reasons. You now have the resources, coupled with court diversion, to have the infrastructure across the state in terms of intervention, in terms of linking people from the criminal justice system into the public health system. The challenge now is going to be, of course, we have the infrastructure on the criminal justice side. The challenge is going to be coordinating the resources in terms of the public on the public health side in the counties, and that's going to be something that I'm going to be working on day one.
Yeah, the program that you mentioned in Chittenden County, the Rapid Intervention Community Court Program, is designed to basically keep nonviolent criminals out of a courtroom. So it's court diversion, basically. They have to agree to drug treatment if that's their problem and to counseling. And then if they succeed, they don't have to go to court. They basically don't have to have that on their record. So that's something that you want to work on really boosting in a statewide way?
Yeah, it's a little different than court diversion. When you talk about court diversion, typically you're talking about first-time offenders. And what we have to do, and I've always made the analogy of, if we have a highway and at the end of the highway is a jail, we should have exit ramps all the way based on need, based on risk. So if it is that low-level offender, a kid threw a ball through a window or did something stupid, sure, court diversion works. Rapid intervention is not for first-time offenders. It's for people who have been throughout the system, who have criminal histories, regardless of their criminal histories. We use science. We use evidence-based risk assessments to measure risk, to measure need. And then in lieu of prosecution, so no charge, in lieu of prosecution, it is the link to the social service agency, the counseling, the doctor, the methadone clinic in the community. We get releases signed. It is a voluntary program. And we have attempted to redefine accountability. And we're not the clinical workers, but what we're doing is ensuring compliance, saying, hey, is TJ Dunneman doing what he's supposed to be doing at the 30, 60, 90-day mark? Really taking that public health approach of harm reduction, of breaking down the barriers to healthcare and getting people the help they need. What that's also going to do is free up the resources in our traditional system, our traditional criminal justice system, to really ensure that we have the resources and the bed space in our jails for folks who truly pose a threat to our public safety. And so having a coordinated, unified, uniformed criminal justice system across the state of Vermont is something that is good for public safety, and it's good for our bottom line.
What percentage of that repeat nonviolent crime is driven by drug use and drug abuse?
The vast majority. The vast majority. And you got to include alcohol in that, Jane, as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority, I mean, look, I'm sitting in my office today. If I went downstairs to the second floor at 1 o'clock, you are going to see a litany of cases. And I can guarantee you this, that the vast majority, either 75, 80, upwards to 90%, there was not only going to be drugs and alcohol, but here's the other crisis in this state that we have to address: mental illness. The issue of the co-occurring mental health crises coupled with the substance abuse is a perfect storm in this state. And what we have to do is redefine what public safety looks like. And if you're asking the police and prosecutors to deal with it, we're not going to make much progress because our tools are limited. A jail cell and a probation term isn't going to fix somebody who is sick. And so we have to make sure that we're making strategic investments in our community, making sure that we have robust and accessible mental health treatment in our schools, not just for kids, but for their families. And we got to put political correctness to the side and make sure that we're going to the folks who are at risk, understanding that prenatal care is a great service to provide in terms of making sure that mom and baby are healthy. And I'm a big believer in early childhood education. Those early years of 0 to 3, 0 to 5, it creates the path for people's rest of their lives. I don't know if you've done much talking about adverse childhood experiences, but this issue of substance abuse, the issue of mental illness, the issue of poverty, the issue of domestic violence, all these factors for kids who grow up in these homes where these things are present have lifelong impacts, higher rates of mental illness, higher rates of addiction, lower life expectancy. So we got to make sure that when we're talking about public safety, we're talking about healthcare, that we're talking about early education, that we're talking about mental illness, mental health counselors. And here's the thing, it's cheaper than a jail cell. It's cheaper than a jail cell. It costs $79,000 to incarcerate a woman in the state of Vermont. $79,000. And when you look at the outcomes, the recidivism rate, depending on how you calculate it, is close to 50%, meaning 5 out of 10 of folks who are in our jails are back in our jails at a cost of $79,000. I think we can do better. I think we can be smarter. I think it's going to take some leadership, but it's understanding that public safety is about our community.
So, TJ Dunneman, we just have a minute left here, but we got a note from Francis in Mount Holly who has a question for you, saying, if the federal government takes up an aggressive effort to remove illegal immigrants and looks to states to provide support, how would you see Vermont responding?
I think Vermont is going to respond how we've always responded, which is to be tolerant, to be accepting, to understand that we are a state and a country of immigrants, and that this is something that I'm very concerned about. It's something that is going to be a priority for me. I'm already thinking and reaching out to folks about how we respond to this issue. This is going to be a defining moment. Not just for our state, but I think our country, and we all have to be prepared.
So you said even on election night, you are worried about President-elect Trump, and you will be working against policies that you don't see as right for Vermont or right for Vermonters.
I am worried about the rhetoric from President-elect Trump during the campaign. Has he moderated a little bit after the campaign? Yes, he has. But, you know, I got to tell you, Jane, on my desk right now are petitions for folks who otherwise would be subject to deportation based on rather minor criminal offenses here in the state of Vermont. So this idea that we're deporting criminals, that is a wide net. And we are going to be catching a lot of folks who I don't think pose a public safety threat. In fact, our folks are doing quite well in our community and are assets in terms of promoting a good and healthy community.
Well, so we'll have to talk to you about that as this progresses. And once you're sworn in, TJ Donovan will be Vermont's next attorney general come January. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Over this election season, and particularly in the last week, a lot of women have been having conversations with friends and colleagues about what it's like to be a woman in this particular cultural and political moment. Tomorrow on the show, we're moving that conversation into the studio. We've invited a group of women to dive into some pretty big questions: how they're thinking about and noticing sexism, opportunity, personal identity, and the messages that are reverberating for women and girls right now. Stay tuned for that tomorrow at noon on Vermont Edition.